Parshas Beshalach. Parshas Beshalach. A lot to talk about. Very hard to finish Parshas Beshalach. Very triumphant, very redemptive. The first couple of psukim are very, very different tone than all the sorrowful, depressing, despondent psukim we've read about the Jewish people struggling in Mitzrayim. Vahi Beshalach Yehuda. Vahi Beshalach Paro Asa'am. They came that armed to the teeth of Bnei Yisrael, Yatsu B'Yad Ramah. A beautiful psukim about Am Yisrael's triumph. And this is a classic case where the style of psukim matches the content. The content is very triumphant, victorious, marching, facing. I mean, think about the parallel parak in Tanakh, which we recite so often in Hallel, much more poetic, much more visual, but say Yisrael mi Mitzrayim, Beis Yaakov me Amloes, Haisa Yehudan Likocho, Yisrael mam Shalosav, Hayamra Avayanos, the waters ran away, Hayarden Yitzisov. So they're describing the march to the desert, but in a micro sense, they're describing Parshas Beshalach. Hayamra Avayanos, Betzei Yisrael mi Mitzrayim. So if you just take Betzei Yisrael as a gloss for Parshas Beshalach, you realize how, put it this way, this is the high point in Jewish history. Everything else falls apart a few weeks later. This is Chaf Aleph Nisan. The countdown, so to speak, backwards to Shavasar B'Talmud, when it all breaks apart, when Jewish utopia disintegrates, and everything that we've all been through becomes a reality, the clock is ticking. So you can go back to one moment in Jewish history and freeze it. Do over. It would be Parshas Beshalach, Yisro, Beshalach Yisro, Terumah Tzavah, four Parshios. Four parashiyos that we've been waiting to reclaim and we've been waiting to rehabilitate for thousands of years. So this is the parsha. And yet right in the middle of Parshas Beshalach, right in the beginning of the middle of the beginning, there's a throwback story to something that took place well before Parshas Beshalach in the timeline, chronologically. Didn't really take place in Parshas Beshalach. In Parshas Beshalach, the Jews are in the desert. They are circumventing a circuitous route to avoid the Plishtim, right? The easiest way from Egypt to Israel is to go up the coast, go through Gaza. But that would mean going up the coast, and that would mean facing the Plishtim and their armies. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu recognized the Jewish people were still too vulnerable, still too fragile. One of the great unspoken miracles of 48 is not just that we repelled so many hundreds of thousands of Arab legionnaires, and not just, but we did it with Holocaust refugees. We did it basically with an army of ragtag refugees, even those who didn't go through the Holocaust. Part of army training, some of you will have the schus to be in the army, have the schus to be part of training, part of his mental. Their pride, strength, discipline, courage. And these are not necessarily the day-to-day attitudes and experiences of slaves who for hundreds of years have lost their identity, hundreds of years have lost their national fiber, hundreds of years have been persecuted, have been subjugated, have been molested, have been ridiculed, have been scoffed at. The psychological warfare in slavery, in many cases, is much worse than the physical persecution, physical toil. So the notion that slaves, newly released slaves, should face the Plishtim was unthinkable to HaKadosh Baruch Hu, even at the height of the year of miracles. I mean, this is a miracle. Hashem can split the sea. Hashem can rain down 10 plagues and afflictions on the Egyptians. But the notion that Jewish people are going to face off against the Plishtim, or the Pashtas, that's too much of an ace for HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Nothing is too much of an ace for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, but that's a level Hashem isn't willing to go to at this stage of history. Hashem can do it, obviously. Not willing. Fast forward 3,000 years, and newly released refugees from the Holocaust are battling tooth and nail, underarmed and underorganized against crack teams of Arab legionnaires. So in many ways, the Nisim of 1948 eclipsed the Nisim of the beginning of Parshas Beshalach, in many ways. So in the middle of this torrent of miracles, leaving Mitzrayim, and all of a sudden the Torah records a story that took place in Parshas Bo, before they were in the desert, before they were at the Yam Suf. What happens in Parshas Bo? This is a clear historical enjambment, where there's a historical non sequitur, where the chronology is thrown off in order to make a point. What happens in Parshas Yisro? Well, it's chronicled in Parshas Beshalach. Vayikach Moshe es atzmos yosef imo ki hashpeh hashbiah as b'nei Yisrael lemar pakol yifkor alakim eschem mizeh valitem es atzmosai mizeh tchem. When did Moshe retrieve the atzmos Yosef, the bones of Yosef? Parshas Bo. They're already in the desert. He didn't go back. He didn't forget it. Why is this story inserted into Parshas B'Shalach? The answer is to highlight Moshe's heroism and his sensitivity. Because on that day, everyone was really busy. On that day, they were busy with Mikne Kavei Meod, as the Torah records in Bo, with getting rid of the Korban Pesach, as the Torah records in Bo, with carrying their matzah, as the Torah records in Bo, with borrowing Kalim from the Mitzrayim, all of these religious responsibilities, as well as personal life. I mean, you're a human being. You're not just a Oved Hashem caught in some prophetic arc or national experience. You're also a human being, getting your family out, looking after your children. And it would be perfectly legitimate for any one person that day to forget about an ancient promise to a dead grandfather who they never met. And you know the person with the greatest excuse? The greatest reason to acquit himself that day? To say, look, I'm so busy. I'm so responsible. I have so many duties. This is the last thing that I should be attending to. It's Moshe Rabbeinu. Because Moshe has the weight of an entire nation on his shoulders. And he has to worry about Paro perhaps launching a counterattack. I mean, he's the leader. People are worried. You sense their worry next week in Parshas Yisrael where they are seeking knowledge and information and input and questions. And Moshe has to attend to their needs. Mea Boker Ad Arev in Parshas Yisrael. It would be perfectly legitimate for Moshe to take a pass. And Moshe doesn't take a pass. Moshe feels every bit as responsible, every bit as dutiful, every bit as beholden to the bones of an ancient grandfather who didn't even share a mother with his grandmother. You'd think it would be one of the six Shvatim. Excuse me, one of the two Shvatim, Yosef and Binyamin, who feel greater allegiance and greater loyalty, fidelity to Yosef. And it's Moshe Rabbeinu, from Shevet Levi, son of Yocheved and Amram, grandson of Kehas, great-grandson of Levi, who senses this responsibility. And that is precisely what makes Moshe Rabbeinu so heroic. We haven't yet seen Moshe's religious accomplishments. He's yet to be the Ish Elokim. He's yet to be the man standing at Har Sinai. Life creates a swirl, especially the modern world. You're more busy than any of your ancestors ever were. And you pay great, great, great costs. I mean, a great cost to that busyness that we have. Busyness is the homage that modern man pays to lack of meaning. If we just convince ourselves that we're busy, we assume we have meaning. Don't ever confuse busyness with meaning. The two are not the same. On an even playing field, it's easier to find meaning when you're not busy. Because then you think about life and you delve into the depths of experiences. You sit by a tree, by the river, talking to a person for 3 hours, thinking, contemplating, delving, quiet, thought, pensive. The busier you are, the less depth, the less reflection, the less consideration. But we convince ourselves, like the homage we pay, we convince ourselves that we have meaning. Sometimes that's a real, we're still, in my opinion, recovering from the crisis of meaning in the 20th century. Man had his world so neatly structured in antiquity, and those two world wars brought it all crashing down. The entire world was looking for what's the meaning of life? What does it all mean? And pretty much the last 30, 40 years, everyone's taken a pass. We can just entertain ourselves nonstop. They don't have to think about meaning, so we'll just watch movies and sports, listen to music, and celebrate Steve Jobs. And we don't have to think about meaning because we're too busy being it. But we'll wake up from that slumber. At some point, people are going to wake up and realize it can't be endless meaning and diversion. Entertainment is diversion. It's not meaning. But part of our defense mechanism is we're busy. Well, look at my schedule. That's my schedule. I must be doing meaningful things. And very often, they battle, right? The busyness is the enemy of meaning. There's an old adage, ask a busy person. If you have something to do, ask a busy person. It's ironic, because if someone's busy, then they probably have less time. But if they're busy with good and productive activities, it's because they don't take passes. They don't acquit themselves. They don't excuse themselves. I want to do more. So I'm on this committee, and I'm on that committee, and I'm a teacher, and I'm a this, or I'm a Rebbe, or I'm a professional, or I'm a Chevra Kedisha, or I'm going to be involved in the Chesed. Some people use one chesed as an excuse for excluding themselves from another chesed. This is my position. This is my rank. The second you start thinking about rank, position, place, the second you start applying artificial, inflated, fake titles to yourself and identities, and you start fencing yourself, well, doesn't, I shouldn't be doing this because it doesn't pasta. It's not appropriate. You know, pasta, I'm a so-and-so, I'm a this. It doesn't pasta that I should be. Or you start playing roles. And those roles stifle your horizons and your ability to just be a normal human being that takes whatever opportunity for chesed, for matzen tovim, for mitzvahs, for helping, big chesed, small chesed, There's no person that ever lived that had a greater title and greater ability to create that entitlement or that profile than Moshe Rabbeinu. He's the last person that should be scraping that coffin out of the ground. He's the last person, according to the Medrash, who has to be hauling it out of the swamp, because according to the Medrash, we're stuck in a swamp. He has to battle these alligators for Yosef's kever. He's the last person. Vayikach Moshe es asmos Yosef imo ki ashbeah ashbeah. Back of his mind, front of his mind, is a promise to an ancient grandfather, and that can't be neglected just because it's the greatest day in Jewish history. I mean, it's the greatest day in Jewish history. That's it. One day, Tesvav Nisan, nothing comes close. And it's a busy day. It's not a quiet, contemplative day like Vav Sivan. Everyone's standing on the mountain thinking, experiencing, imbibing Hashem's word. Everyone's scurrying around. It's a lot of frenetic activity. Moshe Rabbeinu remains calm. And it's that contrast between the psukim around Moshe and Moshe that's so important for the Torah. Everyone is scurrying around, worrying where they're heading, collecting their people, collecting their family, their goods. Moshe Rabbeinu, focus, Vayikach Moshe. And what's interesting about it is not just that he attends to it, but the way he attends to it. It's a famous Gemara in Nazir, which I quoted for you. The Gemara wants to know if someone is Tamei Meis, someone touches a dead body, which part of the Machaneh are they excluded from? So they can't walk into the Machaneh Shechina, which means they can't walk into the Beis HaMikdash, they can't walk into the area of the Heichal, but they can walk into Machaneh Leviah, which is more or less Yerushalayim, I would say more or less Yerushalayim, or parts of Yerushalayim, which is very important today. Many people go up to the Harabayis. As much as we can become untamei, tahor, from our various tumults, we can't alleviate our tumas meis. We're all tamei meis. We come into contact with dead bodies, directly, indirectly, and we don't even have a paraduma. So we're all tamei meis. Which means that if not for people, Rav Goren, Zecher Tzadik Levracha in particular, who felt that he was able to map different parts of the Harabayis, parts that are considered the Heichal, where you can't walk into, parts that are considered the Harabayis that you can walk into, that are equivalent to Machaneh Leviah, if not for this mapping, you couldn't go up. And those people, many people who don't go up today, don't go up for this reason. Because they're not sure, even though the maps are pretty authentic and accurate, maybe it is a mistake. So, legitimate on each side. And you know, certainly, you should all feel completely empowered and completely legit to take both positions. Some people feel we should go up and we should try to take advantage of the greater presence. Some people feel that either halachically or experientially puts too much emphasis on messianic activity rather than focusing on, there's always that balance. To be involved in messianic activity always requires balance, judgment, making sure you prioritize. You know, the messianic fervor can get people carried away, as we see so often throughout history, sometimes so often in our own days. So that's why it's important, you know, if people learn Haredi yeshivas, for example, don't have to deal with this challenge, don't have to deal with this divot, so to speak, because in their position, from their perspective, 2014 is the same as 1814, or the same as 1614, and it's all about Torah, mitzvahs, and davening, and halacha, and normative behavior. The second you open, you take that genie out of the bottle, and it's redemptive, and it's messianic, so it could lead to very, very, this is what always concerned Chazal, so you have to be careful. We're living in a messianic community, and we're living in a, we should all call ourselves messianists, you shouldn't be feel allergic. No, when you go back to Maryland, you tell your friends you're a messianist. Seriously, you should be proud to carry that title. A couple years ago, I was interviewed for the New York Times, and they were baiting me because they found a rabbi without a beard who spoke fluent English. And what do I feel about those crazy settlers in Hebron? I said, I think they're great. I'm part of their community. They said, no, the ones who carry the rifles. Those days, I used to carry an Uzi because I did try to take out my Uzi. I carry a rifle. No, Rabbi, those crazy gun-toting messianists. I said, I'm a gun-toting messianist. So I refused to be baited into disassociating myself with my brothers in Hebron. Now, I said, well, you obviously are a little different. What do you feel good? I said, well, I'm messianic, and I feel that every centimeter of this land is ours and should be ours, and I'm actively campaigning towards it. And however, I feel that human rights should be respected and civil rights should be respected, and I feel that violent means should be adopted. And basically, I said, you can write this. And I'm a messianist who feels that messianism should be sprinkled with pragmatism. That was like the quote that I gave them, sprinkled with pragmatism. But in my sense, I'm messianic. I'm not living here because of Rami Levi. I'm living here because of a messianic vision. Rami Levi isn't dead. They're going to be rolling that English cake. But I think it's a vision of where we're supposed to be. Of this is going to be our land. And this room that we're sitting in will not be a movie theater one day, will not be a men's club, will not be a country club, as all your yeshivas, including the new ones that have just been built, Ariel, all your yeshivas are destined to be in Teaneck and in Los Angeles and in Memphis. One day, Be'ezus Hashem, it's great to have shuls, and it's great to have schools, and it's great to have communities and homes, but one day, I have news for you, all of your homes will be, not your homes, all your schools will be movie theaters and churches and bowling alleys and nursing homes and nursing schools and even around, I don't know, I want to buy around now, but so I want to buy even that in your homes. And this will be a Be'ezus, this will witness Mashiach. This room will say, oh, that's where Elon sat, and that's where David Simcha sat, and that's where Noah sat, and that's where, when the people who watch Mashiach come will welcome Mashiach, they'll welcome him to Elon Shavuot, along his journey through Eretz Yisrael. So, are you allowed to walk into Machane Leviyah? Getting back to Gemara and Nazi, a little bit of a sidebar. So Gemara says that a Tamei Meis can walk. He can't be a Machane Shechina, but he can't walk into Machane Leviyah. And there are certain other types of tumos that have to actually walk out of all three machanos. For example, Mitzara. Ba'adad Yeshe, Michutz Machane Moshevo. Mitzara shall leave all three machanos. But a Tamei Meis can walk into the middle Machane Leviyah. How do we learn this from Moshe? We learn this from Moshe. Moshe, the Gemara says in Nazir, obviously lived in Machane Levi. He was a Levi. Moshe was Tamei all 40 years in the desert. Except when Hashem had to speak to him, he went to the mikvah and had a paraduma. How do we know Moshe was Tamei all 40 years in the desert, Tamei Meis? This pasuk, one word. Look at the pasuk. Vayikach Moshe, line number 4. Es atzmos Yosef, imo! Imo! Look at the Gemara Nazir, source base, line 2. Imo! B'mechitzasa. Moshe did not delegate these bones after he raise them from the Nile River or from the mausoleum. He says, no, I've got more important things to attend to. Therefore, find some caddy, find some bureaucrat, find some, you know, second league governmental official to deal with the bones, because I've got important things to deal with. Moshe, he didn't just attend to it, he personalized it. He saw this as just as noble. He saw this as just as important, just as redemptive. As splitting the sea, receiving the Torah, performing miracles, providing man. It's in there with the same. He didn't allow, because he could do both. Obviously, push came to shove, and there were millions of people waiting for man, so he could should delegate the Atzmos Yosef to someone else. But he's able to do both. And he performed both with the same zeal, with the same personal ownership, with the same attitude and perspective. And Lotus, emo here isn't a metaphor. You could say Imo means a metaphor that he always had it on his mind. No, the Gemara in Nazir is learning a real halacha. There's a real halacha to be learning. Imo means he came into contact with it. He was Tamei Meis, and from his Tumas Meis, and obviously the fact that he lived 40 years in Machane Leviyah, we then can learn halacha Meisa, that a Tamei Meis, that you can go up to the Har HaBayis because of Parshas Peshach. If not for the drasha that Chazal derived from Parshas Peshach, no one here would be allowed to go up to Har HaBayis because he'd all be deemed Tamei Meis and we wouldn't know where they can walk. I mean, maybe find them from a different drasha. So this is a real description, not a metaphor that Moshe attended to or was concerned with it. This is Allah. Imo b'mechitzasa. So it's not just that Moshe checked it off. Yeah, it's important. And Moshe Rabbeinu, I shouldn't take a pass. But he personalized it, he relished it, he owned it, he enjoyed it. How often do you perform chesed and you don't really enjoy it? And you don't personalize it? Now, it's important to be able to do that also, because the highest madrega is to personalize it, but even if you can't personalize it, some people, because they can't personalize it, they avoid chesed. Sometimes you have to just shut your disassociative perspective off and just do it. But the highest madrega is to really identify with it and to really feel a person's distress. In this case, the person is dead. So just feeling historical need and feeling Yosef suffering with the prospect that he'd be landlocked in Mitzrayim and deified as a pagan idol. And for Moshe, this is a person he never met. He never meets Yosef HaTzadik. And in theory, he could harbor some dissonance towards Yosef. It's like different mother. He was the reason we were in Mitzrayim. Certainly, Yosef was part of the Egyptian hierarchy, and Moshe rebels against that hierarchy. So it's not as if this is in a sweet spot. That Moshe, oh, this is my grandfather Levi who defied the Egyptians. I'm going to serve him right. This is someone that he could very easily disassociate with, feel alienated to a degree by. No. And the third part of this whole story is not just does Moshe attend to it because it's his duty, because it's his calling, because it's historical arc, because he's a leader, he has to show leadership to others. The best way you show leadership to others is by doing, not by demonstrating or chiding or instructing. Something to do, do it, you'll be surprised how people pitch in. It's something to do, do it. And remember this for the rest of your life. It's an adage, if you remember this, it should be your honor to fulfill tasks. In a culture of indolence, people try to avoid tasks. People try to avoid work. People try to avoid responsibility. It should be your honor to be the responsible one. It should be your honor to do the dirty work. It should be your honor to clean up a table. It should be your honor to do the dishes. It should be your honor to take out the dirt, to take out the garbage, as the Kohen did every day in Beis HaMikdash. One of the first of all those, Trumas Hadeshen, clean up the Mizbech. And Kohanim fought tooth and nail over that honor. To the point that the Gemara in Yoma says that at one point, they had a race to get up to the Mizbech, and one coin pushed the other coin, and he broke his leg or something, and they had to start a lottery mechanism in order to avoid that. I don't know if you guys still watch, but there was a show that was very, very popular in the 90s. Probably it's a little bit ancient. For you guys, Seinfeld, right? Everyone still is Seinfeld. Everyone loves it. Just be careful. Programs that don't have sex and violence sometimes are more dangerous than ones that do. Sometimes I feel more comfortable recommending to people to watch a shoot 'em up with a couple bad scenes and a couple curse words that you know how to avoid, because the moral messages are black and white. Good, evil, good guys, bad guys, you know, work and commitment and loyalty and sacrifice, and these are good values. And you just know the bad scenes to avoid, then you'll avoid the bad scenes. Sometimes the, so to speak, clean shows that everyone gets a ticket. Yeah, they're clean. I want to watch the clean shows. They don't have any sexuality or any violence or any curse words in them. Sometimes the hidden messages are a lot more corrosive. So there's a hidden message in the sign that you can watch them, but just be careful that you watch with cultural. That's part of what we're trying to achieve here. It's not being exposed to culture. It's being subservient to culture. I'll talk about this in a few weeks about the Super Bowl. It's not watching, but it's selling your neshama to these. It's identifying with it. If you sit on the side, you always see a good comment. You watch it, you laugh, they're good jokes. But you have to be careful, how much is it worming itself into my neshama? Very often people like programs, you'll see, especially your age, you start acting like your favorite actors in the program. You take on some of their phrases and some of their ways of acting and some of their cute lines. You so deeply identify with them that you start becoming them. And that's where you have a real danger. If you were to sit on the side and watch something, you know you're not part of that world. You know you have your own world, your own mission, your own interests. You're an outsider, but you're looking in to see a nice comedy, see a nice acting. But it's the second that you really start identifying and using your own sense. Obviously, the people you should be identifying with, you can't only identify with Jews in your own orbit, but by and large, people that in the entertainment industry are not people you should be identifying with. And the roles that they're playing are not roles you should be identifying with. You identify with people that are committed to great. Every once in a while, there are great movies about great people that can identify with the people they're depicting. So in the Seinfeld series, one of the personalities in the series was always trying to get away with doing as least work as possible. Always trying to fake out his employer, to make believe he was working, to cheat his employer. And that was both a reflection as well as a stimulant for a whole culture of indolence, of trying to work as little as possible and get away with, you know, the boss isn't watching and you can surf on the internet and, you know, take coffee cups. And they're like there's a friend of mine in Alon Shvud, who's like a real entrepreneur. It's a she, and she's really into new technologies, and she constantly is spurning new businesses and selling them for millions. And basically, she's working on some special camera detection. She's going to sell both to department stores and to corporate America. They're going to detect, because evidently, the amount of theft, both in retail stores and in corporate America, you know, stealing things from offices and stealing simple things like 5 pence a day. Or, you know, they had this whole controversy a few months ago in Columbia University. They used to put out Nutella spread for all the students to eat, because that was a cheap food and it has some protein in it. And it turned out that the students were stealing this Nutella spread in large volumes, taking it back to their rooms, and hundreds of thousands of dollars of a year deficit, because girls didn't have 1 ounce of moral fiber. You can't steal someone's food. They're putting it out for you to take a little on your bread, take a little back to your room, and not to take these boxes of Nutella back with you to your room. So this whole corporate world, one day you'll be in corporate America if you choose that route. And you have to work as hard as you can for your employer. Part of being a bentara is to show up to work and be honest. And you're not supposed to be learning a daf gemara when you should be working. That's gzela. It depends. If you're on a project, then you don't have a certain amount of hours. You just have to finish the project. So if you want to take an hour to read a gemara, as long as you can make a project by due date, that's fine. But if you're being paid by the hour to work on a certain project, you shouldn't be opening a gemara. You shouldn't be I mean, within reason. Obviously, you can take a break and open a Gemara, but that's really your responsibility to serve your employer as best as possible. So Moshe is not just someone that attends to it, and not just someone who personalizes it, but there's an amazing third matter. So there are three sources here. The Pasuk, the actual attending to it. Number two, the personalization of keeping it with him. And number three, V'lo od, this is a mechilta. This is a mechilta contrasting the funeral procession of Yaakov with the funeral procession of Yosef. Everyone read about the funeral procession of Yaakov in Parshas Vayichi. Who attended the funeral procession? All of his children, presumably their families, the whole procession. Who took notice of this funeral procession? The Knanim, the residents, right? They said, Evel Kaveh B'Mitzrayim. They saw all these mourners journeying from Egypt. They said, Evel Kaveh B'Mitzrayim. And there's actually a place called Goren Hatad that they was named because of some ceremony that took place that the Knanim mentioned. And maybe even they put their spears in the ground. They made some sign of honor to these Egyptians who were journeying to bury their grandfather in his heritage land, in his land of Maariv Machpelah and Hebron. So this is something that was noticed. This wasn't a quiet, private ceremony. But the Medrash says, oh, that's Yaakov's funeral procession. Let's read about Yosef's funeral procession. You ready? Who marched Yosef to his funeral? Vim Yosef, line number two. Ha'aron, the Aron with the Kruvim, the Hashina, the Akonim, the Halavim, the Chol Yisrael, the Shivanani Akavod. No, you're laughing. I'm laughing also. They weren't there for Yosef's funeral procession. The Aron, the Shechina, the Kohanim, the Levim, they're marching there to Israel. Yosef's the trumpist. Yosef's getting a ride. He's stowaway. This isn't Yosef's funeral procession. He's hanging on. You know, it's like you get a ride and you say, here's the sworn spot. You got a ride on the bus. This isn't your party. But you know what? There's one person who saw this entire entourage as Yosef's funeral procession. Who was it? Moshe. Because from Moshe's standpoint, this wasn't just the historical march to Utopia and the closing chapters of history as it was meant to be. This is also Yosef's funeral procession. He had a sensitivity to every human being, even dead ones. He identified with Yosef so deeply that in his mind, all his grandeur and all his song and dance and all his protocol and all his ceremony, the Anani HaKavod, the Aron, the Shechina, was all to honor Yosef. That's amazing. And let me clearly identify these three levels for you. One is to attend to important tasks, even when your mind is distracted by great things. Two is to personalize it as an honor, rather than delegate it as a chore, even when you attend. I'll do it, but you do it for me. Three is the human level. To realize you're not just performing a task in a chesed, helping out a human being, even when there are 3.5 million other human beings that you're helping out. You focus on person you're helping right here and now. You don't lose individuals in the swarm of collectives. When's the last time you walked into a situation where you were overwhelmed by a swarm of humanity? You walk into a wedding. I'm sure it's going to happen soon. Your friends are going to start to get married. So weddings are going to be situations you find yourself with larger groups of people that you have to digest and process beyond just, you know, your friends from camp, your friends from yeshiva. You may have it a little bit here and there if you've been to weddings. Suddenly you walk in and there are 60 people you know, rather than 10, 20, 30 people you know, which are the groupings you've been accustomed to until now. And as you grow older, and in Mirza Shem, your acquaintances and your circles of friends broaden, it's going to get even more. At my stage, I walk into a room, I could know maybe 250 people in the room. Especially if it's not just my friends and my acquaintances, it could also be Talmidim or families that I'm affiliated with. And how often do you... Are you not speaking with your full attention to the individual that you're talking to right now because you're paying attention to people around that you're not talking to? That's called mindfulness. When you talk to someone, talk to that person. No one else. Not the people waiting to talk to you, not distractions on the side. Try as best as you can. Sometimes you're not able to. Say, you apologize. A second. I need a second to take this phone call. I need a second. That's courteous also. People understand that you may have to interrupt the conversation. But when you're talking to that person, as best as you can, give them your full attention, give them your full interest, your full emotional focus. People know the difference. I know when people are talking to me, or when people are talking through me. They're talking to me, but they're really eyeing the crowd and looking around, waving to other people. And to be honest, I feel really abused. I feel like if you want to talk to me, talk to me. If you don't want to, nah, I don't feel cheated or in any way mistreated When the person, I mean, other things come up. You don't always have. Sometimes a rebbe comes into the room and the person has to stop to excuse me for a second. Or a parent comes into the room, or there's a need, you have to attend to a child. It's totally normal and acceptable that though that person is talking to you, there may be pressures and interventions that are created that will force that person to no longer continue giving you their full attention. That person should then apologize and move on. But if there's nothing else happening, that person is talking to you, but not really talking to you, but talking to other people, or trying to attract other people's attention, communicate with other people in a way that's, you know, that's not just episodic, you know, talk about, by the way, I'll speak in 2 minutes, obviously, but in a way that's really, really chronic. The person isn't talking to you at all. That's a Moshe Rabbeinu. Moshe Rabbeinu for 40 years wakes up every morning. And through his eyes, this isn't just the historical trek. This is Yosef's funeral. He's here at Yosef's funeral. It's also important today in the age of cell phones, because cell phones also make us less mindful of people. Okay, so certainly, the nervous, you know, checking of our cell phones every 2 minutes, unless we're waiting for a call or an important text, and then you apologize. I apologize, I may have to check my cell phone because I'm waiting for a text, I'm waiting. I don't mean to be rude, but this is a really important message. It's not important, something that can wait, put it on the side, and you close it off, or you don't do it. Or you say, excuse me, just give me a second. You can do the same things you're doing, but do it with mindfulness and recognition. It's one of the most important traits in human interaction, and believe me, it's traits that people will be looking for when they hire you, when they want to marry you, when they want to grade you and be your friends. If they sense that you're a mindful person, that you pay attention to that person that you're in the room with, you're going to grade high, you'll be accepted to the job bet quicker, you'll be more a better friend. So just trying to shift. That's what you see at this third level. Three levels. One is moral responsibility, tending to tasks, not getting lost in the frantic, panic, and swarm of the day. Two is personalizing it, owning it, being thrilled, not delegating either actively, or even if you actively delegate, being thrilled to have that opportunity. I'm so thrilled. When someone says thank you to you, the next time you do a chesed for them, your response should be, I'm thrilled, it's my honor to do the chesed. Because very often when you do a favor for someone, you feel a little bit low, you know, they ask you for a favor, they ask you to stay over the house. And I've been the recipient of people's favors, obviously when I travel. Tell the difference. Some people make you feel like $1 million. It was our honor to have you and to host you and to take care of you. And to sometimes I feel like I was a burden, not just in hosting and sleeping over someone's house, but just in day-to-day chesed. And if you can perform a chesed and convey the fact that you're thrilled to do it, you do a double chesed. Not only do you provide the service, but you provide the good feeling. And if you provide the service without the good feeling, in some cases, you don't even get the schar for the service. Because certainly in Staka, the Rambam Paskins, if you get stuck up with a mean face or a frustrated look, and believe me, it's hard. I'm sitting home at night, I've got a lot on my mind, I've got a tight schedule, things to take care of. Sometimes they come in droves. You know, the cars come and they all share the same taxi. One knock after another, but they don't all come together because then you give them less. So it's 5 minutes stationed apart. I'm jumping up like a, you know, like a banshee dog trying to answer the door, and I've got my kid that I'm learning with, and the dishes, and this one's screaming, and this one's yelling, everyone. I'm like, you know, in any normal house, I just every time, thank God, I have, you know, 2-3 steps to the door, try to collect myself, restore my calm, try to greet the person with as much equanimity as I can, try to give whatever I can. Certainly not to make a mean face or an angry face or a disgraceful face, because then I shouldn't even bother opening the door, because I'm not even going to the mitzvah, so I'm just wasting my money or wasting my services and energy. So this is the motion we see. And this is the non sequitur that the Torah programs. The contrast between all the people who had many, many important things to attend to that day, and between Moshe, Vayikach Moshe, Esatzmos Yosef Imo, the focus, personalization, and the interacting with a dead man we never met, but bringing that attitude, this is your funeral, and I'm going to be here at your funeral, attentive as possible. Okay. Second part of the parsha. Maybe a little bit extra tonight, not too much, 6:20, 6:25, nothing terrible, but take a little bit of extra time, if we need it, I'm not sure. In the end of the parsha, I had to make it close the door. In the end of the parsha, they hit Mara. And, as you know, there's a scene there where they're embittered. You start to see the toll of being in the desert. The water is bitter. It's not the water that's bitter, the people are bitter. It's their attitude that's bitter. But after it all is resolved, Torah writes, Shem, Sam, Lo chok u'mishpat v'sham nisal. This is a very, very deep pasuk with many, many layers of meaning. I'll just quote Rashi's level, but it means a lot of things centered around the word samlo, centered around the word chok u'mishpat, very interesting, intriguing phrases, primarily pivoted around the word nisahu. What does nisahu mean? Nisayon, nes, flagpole, miracles. Rashi's pshat, this is based on the Gemara, is that nisahu means training, and that the chok u'mishpat were training mitzvahs. This was a couple weeks before Har Sinai. It's hard to know exactly when, but sometime, let's say, in Chodesh Iyar. The Yam Suf is behind them. Har Sinai is ahead of them. And they have to be trained religiously. This is their training season. I'm sure all of you are sports fans. Every sport team has an exhibition season in which they train their athletes, try to select the better athletes from the less successful athletes, try to develop strategies. Training, so this is the training season. And to train them in mitzvot, they're given chok u'mishpat. They're given a few mitzvot to try on for size, to experiment with, to get accustomed to performing religion. Okay. What are these mitzvot? So let's see Rashi. Rashi tells us there are three mitzvot. One mitzvah makes perfect sense. What's the first mitzvah? Shabbos. If I were to have to choose a mitzvah to train a potential convert, say start with Shabbos. First of all, it's not overwhelmingly difficult. You don't want to necessarily throw the fastballs at him the first moment. You want him to take something that can digest and practice well. Second of all, it's theologically important. Bryas HaOlam, Yetzias Mitzrayim. Third of all, it's culturally identifiable. Every culture has days of rest, so this is a good way to train yourself, Shabbos. What's the final mitzvah? Dinim. Social welfare, civil rights, political justice, judicial systems, laws, damages, loans, contracts, inheritance. Every society needs a judicial system, a constitution, system of laws to protect the rights of the innocent or the weak against those who would abuse them. And this is very progressive. Social welfare. Today you have, fortunately or unfortunately, it's really important. Many of you who are in college campuses have been exposed to this. People whose Judaism has been completely effaced. For them, ritual is no longer compelling. Divinity of Torah isn't compelling. Prophecy, messianic visions, land of Israel, special status of Jews. For them, their entire Judaism is built on social welfare. Universalism, humanism. Trying to improve the world. That's the mission of a Jew, trying to create social welfare. Now, for many people, this is very abrasive. And I certainly want it to be somewhat abrasive to you, because for some, even Orthodox Jews, it occupies a disproportionate role in their overall religious cocktail. But it's part of the cocktail. And it's part of Avram's mission. And Avram's message was to try to change the world, not just to change it religiously, but to say that worshiping a monotheistic God means also improving the human condition. A monotheistic God doesn't want backwardness and regressive societies and suffering. That's the message of paganism, escaping the world to some nirvana-like other world. But the message of monotheism is embracing and changing and perfecting the world. So when you see this, some people make this mistake that Judaism is an all or nothing. Judaism is like an onion, it's layers. The most complete Jew has the most layers. Has ritual, has prayer, has fear of heaven, has messianic vision, has national identity, has sympathy to others, has a world view. That's a complete cocktail. That's a complete apparatus. But even when you find remnants, partial layers, that's something you should appreciate, identify with, endorse, empower people towards. So it's really difficult. A lot of you will see, well, I'm sure Noah and Aaron could probably share, and Jonathan can share some of their experiences. It's very important you endorse this with people that you find, but also in your own world, know that it can't occupy disproportionate identity in terms of your Judaism. There are other parts of Judaism rather than digging ditches for poor people in Argentina, although that's an important part of our religious responsibility as well. But for some people, it displaces others. So these two mitzvahs are obvious no-brainers to throw out the Jews for them to experiment with as they're marching towards Har Sinai figuratively. Shabbos, indeed. What's the third mitzvah nestled between the two in Rashi? Paraduma. Paraduma? Are you kidding me? Paraduma? Now Rashi gets this from the language of the pasuk. Sham, samlo, chok, umishpat. It wasn't just mishpatim, which typically, not only, but as a relief tag will teach you, chok doesn't only mean irrational mitzvahs, it means fundamental constitutional mitzvahs. But in many cases, chok refers to irrational, unknown, mystical, mysterious, occult. Whereas mishpatim are rational, perceptible, humanly intuitive. So at Mara they were delivered. They were challenged to rational mitzvahs, mishpat, but also irrational mitzvahs, chok u'mishpat. Paraduma is the quintessence of chok. Zas chukas hatara, adam kiyamas ba'or. It's a quintessential chok. Shlomo tried to penetrate, amarti ech kema. Shlomo writes, v'hira chokam imeni, I've tried my hardest. He was Einstein, Newton, and Galileo, all wrapped up into one, and he couldn't even penetrate the meaning of paraduma. Paraduma is an enigma wrapped in a riddle, because not only does it not make sense, but it's counterintuitive. You're Tame, I sprinkle the ashes on you, I become Tame, you become Tor. So it's not just imperceptible, but it's wrapped in a riddle. So even when you try to make headway, you're rebuffed. Gil, they need Paraduma now. Can you imagine Amisol? Oh my goodness, you have to learn Paraduma. Are you kidding me? There's a famous Reb Chaim about Paraduma. They didn't have Reb Chaim yet. Are you kidding me? Paraduma? There's no Mishkan, there's no Tuma, there's no Halacha. There's no, they can't even practice Paraduma. They don't even have a coin. Shabbos they can practice. It's going to be Shabbos, don't collect your money. Bada bing, bada bing. Good practice for Shabbos. Dinan, you see in Parshas Yisrael, before our Sinai, they come to ask Moshe, he owes me money, he owes me an ox, he owes me some Egyptian clothing, I took it from him, I borrowed it, he's a Shlomo Chinam. Yalla, Kadima. Paraduma? No one was telling me Tuma didn't exist. Tuma's a halachic state. It's not a spiritual state. People make that mistake. A woman, when she's a nida, is Tame. Judaism is chauvinistic. How could it call women Tame? Impure. Tuma has nothing to do with your spiritual state. Moshe was Tame 40 years in the desert. He was the biggest tzaddik that ever lived. He was Ish Elokim. But he did a mitzvah. Because he attended to a mitzvah, at certain points he couldn't enter the Beis HaMikdash until he went through the purification process. You can be the biggest tzaddik and be Tame. You can be the biggest Rasha and be Tar. Tuma v'tar is simply you come into contact with things that make you Tame and therefore have to remove yourself in the biggest state of Kedusha from the Beis HaMikdash. A woman, when she gives birth, has just accomplished something heroic. She's partnering with HaKadosh Baruch Hu. She's never closer to the Shechina than when she gives birth. But for whatever reason, HaKadosh Baruch Hu goes there that she's Tame. And she has to wait a certain amount of days. She can't accelerate it. She has to bring korbanos and walk back in the Beis HaMikdash. She's a bigger tzaddik when she's sitting outside of the machna those 40 days than the women who are walking around hobnobbing in the Beis HaMikdash. It's nothing to do, and vice versa. When you go to the mikveh, you don't become a better person. You just go to the mikveh. That's why non-chassidim just look at the mikveh excitement a little bit skewed. Like, it doesn't do anything. It's a mikveh. You go into the mikveh, if you're tameh, it doesn't mean you're a bigger tzaddik if you're going to the mikveh. It just means you're no longer tameh from whatever tumah you wanted to remove. So chassidus read a lot more Kabbalistic intonations into the mikveh. Those people who are drawn to chassidus really take the mikveh more seriously. People like myself who don't actively participate. I believe in Kabbalah. We'll talk about this before it stopped. I don't actively practice Kabbalah, so I'm not involved in that world. So I don't really translate mikveh that way. For mikveh, as I go, or Yom Kippur, to make sure that I'm in a physical halachic state of Tara, that I can be omid lefnei Hashem on Yom Kippur. Paraduma? Paraduma? So let me share with you something Rav Amital would tell. These are like one of the five or six most famous sichot of Rav Amital about this Rashi. To help us understand this Rashi, Rav Amital would tell us about a story in the Gemara in Kiddushin, a story you've all read, but it's equally quixotic, equally puzzling. The story in Kiddushin, I'll paraphrase, but you could follow along. They were discussing Kibbutz Avayim, and they asked Rabbi Eliezer, what's the paradigm, what's the epitome of Kibbutz Avayim? It's only a mitzvah you have to think about. Not an easy mitzvah at this stage in life, any stage in life. One of the hardest mitzvahs. There were actually members of Chazal that, so to speak, requested that their parents wouldn't grow old. And they were never daven for that, but like they expressed that, because I know that I can stand up to the expectations of Kibbutz Avayim. These were Gedolim, Rebbe Tarfon, the Gemara says. used to stand and kneel by his mother's bed and let her step on him or step on his hands so her feet shouldn't hit the cold ground. And when the Chachamim heard about Rabbi Tarfon's commitment to Kibbutz Avraham, they said, you haven't reached half the Madrega of Kibbutz. Not even close. It's a very, very hard mitzvah. It's especially hard at this age because you're looking for identity. And when you're searching for identity and autonomy, it's very hard to feel the presence of authority. As you grow older, it's easier to navigate the two, to juggle the two. It's not easy, but you grow into it. It's part of maturity. Right now, to feel your own autonomy, very often, not necessarily people in this room, because Baruch Hashem, you're all quite serious about your religion and quite seriously. You're looking, perhaps, for good authority role models, but a lot of people who have thrown off authority and rebelled is because they're looking to find their identity. And the sooner you find your identity, the easier it is to see someone that's in authority, but doesn't mean he's going to squash who I am, because I have this, I do this, I do that. That's why many people, when they get married, very often it's easier for them. A lot of people who are wandering religiously, when they get married, it's easier to come back. Why is it easier? In part because, no, they're really looking around, but they don't really have the guts to pull the trigger and leave the Jewish community. So marriage is like when you have to make the decision, right? You're in college, you're hanging around, you have your apartment, you can play around, look around, and go here, and go there. They got to get married, and make up your mind. Orthodox, non-Orthodox. No one should chas v'shalom fall to that level. You should all be passionately Orthodox for the rest of your lives. But you'll see, unfortunately, a lot of your friends start to wander, start to get strange ideas into their heads, and lose some of their commitment. But more or less, in many, many cases, a lot of them have to come back. Again, they don't necessarily come back all the way, but you know, they're willing to be, we call, socially Orthodox. You know, live in an Orthodox community, daven in shul, come to shul. Okay, you know, how many mitzvahs they keep. Each little sifkat in the Shulchan Aruch, that's a different story. But basically, they identify as Orthodox and they belong to Orthodox communities. It's also true that when you get married, you have more of an identity. You know, you have a home to go to, you make your own meals, and then it's easier to say, okay, now this is my dad, I have my wife, I have my profession, and I don't feel like I have to build it on my own. Now I can accept authority, which is why it's really, really important. I mean, we're not talking about marriage so much tonight or in these shiurim, but again, there's no rule of thumb, and you know, when you should, when you shouldn't. But by and large, again, it's not something you can control. It's not B'yadar. You can't flip the switch and say, I want to be married. But in terms of your planning, by and large, the second you start to move out of Jewish communities, you know, healthy masses of Jewish community, you really have to be careful not to spend too much time single. Which means that, you know, when you're in college, and Baruch Hashem, most of you are choosing to be in college with actual communities, in case where you live with your parents at home, and you know, you live with, let's say, Toronto or in England or other places where, again, I keep telling the secret of these communities that the boys and girls live at home. They just go into college and come back, and it's a whole different experience. Or Baruch Hashem, where if you, even if you have to live in campuses and you can speak to some of the boys that are back now, you're living in campuses that at least provide some. You can't just, if you just pick a campus somewhere in the middle of nowhere because they have a good department in kosher food, that's a death sentence. You can't. And my message when I go to high schools and I speak to college guidance counselors, I'm sure that I'm listening to this recording, is you can't just gauge suitability of colleges based on Jewish resources. Because that's what they're all into, is a kosher food and a halal house. That's Jewish resources. Good. People who want to have a Jewish identity, keep kosher. You have to ask yourself, does the community have Torah resources? Torah resources are minyan. Torah resources are at least the notion of a base medrash, some svarim around, rabbinic figures, older person. You're not here to be Jewish. You're here to be passionately Jewish and to build your passion around Torah and Torah values. So Baruch Hashem, you know, today there's so many campuses that, again, it doesn't hold a candle to being in a base medrash, doesn't hold a candle to being with people that are, but every person makes their own cheshbonos, and for some people one formula is better than another. But the second you start to leave those communities, for some people it's right after college, for some people, it's a little bit later after you go to graduate school, but different stages. It's really hard. It's really hard in today's world, especially with all the challenges being brought to bear. It's really, really hard to be sincerely from if you're single. And most of you should pinpoint that moment of departure. You know, I'm going to finish college, and then I'm going to go into the workforce and live on the Upper West Side. That point should be where you know, think seriously, you know, a year or two before, now I have to make efforts to get, and make efforts like everything else. How many of you, you don't have to raise your hand, how many of you want to be a doctor? Well, I'm sure some of you, it's not going to happen on their own. You're going to take stages, you're going to prepare yourself, you're going to study. People think that marriage is going to happen on your own. You don't know, for some people it happens. But otherwise, you make efforts. I mean, at a certain point, you have to make it part of your agenda. At a certain point, you have to take time. A lot of people don't, you know, the part of the shidduch crisis is, not just on a personal level, we don't trust. And I speak to a lot of people, they're scared to enter relationships because they may get hurt or hurt someone. Because there's a lot of hurt in our world. And we're not as tamimistic and as trusting. We live in a world of mistrust. And that's the worst thing. What would make you think that you can hurt someone? You'll treat the person properly, you'll communicate with the person, and hopefully you'll find a person that will reflect similar values. So you'll go out, you'll try to date one another, and if it is compatible, it's not. You're not going to slam the phone or curse the person out or be deceitful or date three people at one time. What would make you just go out, put your best foot forward, try to meet people? And you know, this great fear that I'm going to hurt or be hurt in relationships, especially for boys. Girls take it obviously a lot more emotionally, and the hurt is felt a little bit deeply, especially I'm talking to boys now. You know, you shouldn't feel so encumbered and so hesitant. It's not something to think about, and it's not going to just come up on its own. It's not going to, you know, some people are so focused professionally, and so focused financially, and so focused culturally, and so focused. I'll get married because you just assume, you know, I'll find a girl. You'll find a girl. They don't just come into you. You have to make efforts and take away time and say, this is my senior year in college, and 3-4 years from now, whatever you are, and say, now I have to make sure I take fewer courses or join fewer clubs or travel less because it has to be my agenda to get married because, in a few months I'm going to be in who knows where. Living and living as a single is exponentially more challenging than living as a married person, not just because of the sexual pressures and the physical pressures, but simply who you are in terms of your identity. So we're talking about Kivud Avayim. We never got to this. We're talking about Kivud Avayim. So the answer of Eliezer, how far is Kibbutz Avayim? What do you have to say? He said, you know what? I'll show you the extremes of Kibbutz Avayim by citing the example of a guy. I'm sure you'll find great goyim over the next couple of years that you'll learn a lot from. Don't be bashful. Don't be shy. Don't be apprehensive about learning from goyim. Plenty of good people out there that you can learn from. You can't learn the whole thing from. You can't model yourself after them. You can't start to identify with them. I wouldn't recommend that you go have a drink with them in a bar or hang out with them on New Year's Eve because, all right, Tariq Adobe should learn from goyim. Sometimes it's a little bit overemphasized. And sometimes when I speak to people, you know, who are choosing which colleges to go to or where to live, I find this very odd, this statement. I want to know what it's like to live with goyim. I've lived my whole life with Jews. The last I checked, they breathe the same air. They have two nostrils, two eyes, two ears, white teeth, you know, same people. I didn't really go through goyim orientation sessions to learn how to deal with goyim. I'm pretty good at it. You know, I haven't gotten a rating. It's not like I got consumer reviews, but most of the guy on me feel like I'm a pretty good guy. I'm greeted with respect. I treat people with respect. No one's saying mean things. Don't get arrested for, you know, anti-goyim behavior. It isn't rocket science. It's just treating people with respect, finding common ground, feeling a fraternity with everyone on this planet. I certainly feel common, you know, at levels of fraternity. I feel greater fraternity to from Jews, lesser fraternity to non, but there's levels of fraternity. But you, I step on a plane and the person I'm sitting next to, we're both human beings, we share the planet, we're both parents, we're both adults, we're both, you know, we're both trying our best. If he's here, she is a good person. I connect at that level. That's the secret of relationships, finding common ground and connecting at that common ground and trying to appreciate the common ground. So Chazal weren't embarrassed to look at a guy for inspiration. And in part, they wanted to emphasize how native Kibbutz Avayim should be, that even goyim who don't have a commandment still excel at Kibbutz Avayim. And the truth is, you should see a lot of people, you know, even people that, I read this very, very cute little article, I forget where I read it a couple of weeks ago, about the current president of Iran, Husani, is his name? What? Rouhani, right? So I'm talking about how he's a little softer, a little less jihadist than some of his predecessors, and they're trying to show the human side. So yeah, this picture, this very foreboding picture hanging up on every wall in Tehran, and the great peril. Meanwhile, this guy evidently calls his mother every day. First of all, I didn't know he had a mother. Like he himself could be, you know, 80 years old, but you know, it's just the beard that does it. He's, you know, in his 60s, and his mother's still alive. He calls his mother every day. It's a nice thing. Nice thing to learn. You can learn even from the, you know, the prime minister of wherever he is, the cleric leader of Iran. You call your mother every day. Try to, you know, be close as best as possible. So there's nothing wrong with learning from Gaim. As long as you understand, you know, A, you can learn more from, you know, people within your orbit, and indeed, it's, you learn, but you don't identify with their being. You just pick traits, and you say, this is a trait I want to identify with, I want to copy. So they learned from Dama ben Asim. What was Dama ben Asim's story? He lived in Ashkelon, and one day, he discovered these great big gemstones. in his backyard. Great big gemstones necessary for which part of the coins begadim? Anyone know? Not the choshen. Choshen also had gemstones, the smaller ones, but what do we call the article of clothing that had shoulder straps? Ephod. The ephod, not the iPhone. Steve Jobs. The ephod. The ephod had these shoulder straps, and the straps were fastened by these huge gemstones, really heavy gemstones. And these stones were large enough to have six names on each. The choshen had smaller stones with one name on each, 12 stones. These gemstones had six on each, so they're pretty heavy, not too heavy. Clean God, no more. You can imagine, these are pretty expensive. I mean, you can see even today, small, you know, diamond this size could be hundreds of millions of dollars. You can imagine these huge. These are really expensive, really exorbitant. The Chachamim were coming with their checkbooks open. They were going to come and purchase these gemstones from Dan Ben Asina. He's going to be a millionaire. He struck it rich. What happened? You all know the story? The gemstones were locked in a safe. And where was the key to the safe? Under his father's pillow. That's my favorite Gemara. Don't wake your father up when he's sleeping, right? Father's sleeping, don't wake him up. Okay. Although I tell my son, you know, please, if we find those gemstones and I'm sleeping, wake me up. Shake me, you know, pour cold water on me. You know, don't follow this Gemara. But for some reason, the Gemara doesn't say what Thomas' father said when he woke up. You idiot! You were himself. Why are you so righteous? I shouldn't have sent you to yeshiva. But yeshiva forgot him. Anyway, so yeah, he didn't wake his father up. The moral of the story, don't buy a safe with a key. You know, buy a code. You know, the key just knows the code. Okay, so he lost money. Dalman Ben Asina lost money. But the continuation of the Gemara is something that very often you don't read about. The next year, he really struck it rich. A paraduma was born into his flock, a red heifer. Those are even less common. And the gemstones could fetch a couple hundred million, these could fetch a couple billion. So now he really made it to EC Street. Now he's really in the money. So Chazal come, even bigger checkbooks, even bigger checks. And they're about to cut him a check. And Dhamma says, this is the Gemara Kiddushin, more or less, he says, look, I can ask you for any price I want. I know I got you behind the barrel. I could ask you for anything, blank check, I can fill it in. Tell you what, don't pay me the worth of a paraduma. Just pay me the money I lost last year for the Avnei HaShoah. I'm not looking to make paraduma money. I'm looking to make Avnei HaEifod money. Whatever money I lost last year, pay me. I'm not asking you for paraduma sums. What's going on here? Why does the Gemara quote this story? To show that Dhamma wasn't greedy? So Rav Amital explained to us that what Dhamma was saying was as follows. He says, last year, I fulfilled the mitzvah of Kibud Av V'Aim. At a cost. I lost the money of the gems. That makes sense. Kibud Av V'Aim, I can wrap my head around. I deserve to be compensated for last year's mitzvah. But morally, I just don't feel right taking money for this year's mitzvah, because paradum is not a mitzvah I can make sense of. So he was a righteous Gentile. I didn't feel right taking money for religious performances that he couldn't understand. Last year, I went to bat. I performed the mitzvah. A great cost, great sacrifice. I deserve compensation for that mitzvah last year. But this year's mitzvah that happened to fall into my grid, paraduma, I don't understand. It's a choke. And therefore, I don't deserve to be compensated. So give me Avnei HaShoah money, Avnei HaEifod money, not paraduma money. Point is that Judaism has a very unique blend, which is rarely duplicated between the rational and the mystical. Between that which we can understand and the incomprehensible. So using our brains to decipher and recognizing that religion will forever remain a mystery, and we submit to the mystery of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And the mitzvahs that are chokhs remind us. As much as we try, there are big debates. We try to understand kashrus, not try to understand kashrus. We try to understand mila. Every time they come out with another survey about whether circumcision is a better deterrent for cancer, less deterrent for cancer, it's better. Every time they come out, when shellfish is healthy, is not healthy. You know, everyone reminds themselves, should we see HaKadosh Baruch Hu's mitzvahs as possessing reasons that we can understand and access? But there's one mitzvah that HaKadosh Baruch Hu delivered that will forever remain incomprehensible. To remind us that as much as we understand, we're not going to understand everything. And that's why this mitzvah of Paraduma deals with what part of life? The one part of life that we'll never understand. What part of life do we never understand? Death. We have no answers for death. Humans can't solve the tumma that death bestows. And Hashem has to sweep in from Shemayim with his divine wisdom and resolve death and the contamination that comes, not the physical contamination, the lawful contamination that comes from death. That's why the only tahara for the tumma of Mavis is the tahara of the Paraduma, the tahara that's driven by a divine fuel, not by human cognition. And there's some religions, and today by and large is all about the rational and the empirical. And don't enslave yourself to that attitude. If you, in my opinion, if you think you can proceed successfully, religiously, on purely empirical grounds, in my opinion, you will fail. You will fail. Religion is delivered truths. Religion is a tradition. Religion is trusting. Religion is hooking yourself up to people that deliver those truths to you. I hook myself up, you hook yourself up to me. We're hooks. You hook up to someone. And the Chalak reminds us that Hashem is a mystery, and I will never crack that mystery. And Yirat Shamayim means you submit to that mystery. As much as you try to understand, and you try to proceed, in the end, you submit to HaKadosh Baruch Hu's divine mystery. Chukav u'mishpatav li'Yisrael. Hashem gave the Jewish people chukim u'mishpatim. Lo asachem l'chogav. We read about it every day, Tehillim. No other religion has been able to distill that blend between the rational and the non-rational. Between the understandable, and that's what's being highlighted by the Gemara Kedushin. Tamar ben Asina was really just an honest person. He says, I don't have a place in my religion for the inscrutable, for the non-understandable, for the incomprehensible. I don't, and therefore I shouldn't profit over it. I'm willing to profit over Kibbutz. That makes sense. I should honor my elders. I can't profit over something that has no meaning to me. There's no meaning to us in terms of comprehension. There's great meaning to us in terms of recognizing and acknowledging the mystery of religion. That's why at Mara the Jews were given Paraduma. Because they had to be trained to see religion through these dual lenses. They had to be trained to understand it. In a few weeks, I'll stand at Har Sinai. Many of these mitzvahs you'll understand. Some of them you won't understand. Are you sturdy enough, emotionally, mentally, to accept both? Are you sturdy enough to accept Kivud Avim and Dinim and Shabbos and all these mitzvahs that you'll be able to rationalize and comprehend and internalize? They're able to accept the parts of religion that you won't be able to understand. And try on paradua for size. Try it on. Practice it. Maybe you can't actively practice it. You can't sacrifice a paraduma, but read about it, think about it, discuss it. Sham samlo chok u'mishpat. V'sham nisal. I'm testing you now. Because if you only prove capable of mishpat, you're not ready for Har Sinai. If you're capable of chok u'mishpat, Niso, now you're ready for Har Sinai. That's why at Mara, Paraduma plays such an important role. Because it trained them for religion. You guys are training also. This is a one long Mara for you. You know, you're training through different media. Some people train through learning a lot. Some people train through a more of a balance between learning and non-learning. It's all your own training, right? I don't know how many of you are going to one day be Rabbanim and yeshiva teaching Rashbas and Ritvas all day. Hopefully you'll have some encounter with them. But in part, we want you to see the beauty of Tara, the importance of Tara, the divinity of Tara, the depths of Tara. But as we stress so often, it's training you so that you go to Minyan 3 times a day, so that you'll be Koveitim, so that you'll be a Baal Chesed, so that you're working, so you'll take religion seriously and want to excel in religion. That's what it's all about. It's what we're training you towards. And part of your training has to be, okay, there are parts that I'm going to understand, but am I able to live with question marks? Question marks aren't a sign of failure. Question marks just mean I don't understand at all. Question marks in your life, question marks in halacha, question marks in, you know, how do we reconcile the two, science and religion, and how could HaKadosh Baruch Hu create such harsh conditions for homosexuals, and how do we understand the role of women? And then as much as we try, we may not have all the answers. Sometimes we have answers, we just don't have the tools to resolve. So I have the answer for Iguna. You know, my answer for Iguna is take the person out back and beat the stuffing out of him. I have the answers for the Sava. I just don't have the tools because we live in democracies and I can't just assault people. So some things we have answers for, we just don't have the tools. Some things we don't have answers for. So it doesn't mean the whole thing collapses. You know, there's evil in the world. People get so frustrated by the amount of suffering in the world. Part of it is we just are attuned to more suffering than we ever were, because the second 50 people perish in an earthquake in Mexico, it's on your phone and you're watching it. You know, 500 years ago, you saw much of their good in the world, and you weren't really exposed to people. You saw people around you living and breathing and surviving, and the conditions were harsh, the conditions were much more difficult to survive. But now we're aware of the fragility of the human condition, of the violence that exists in our world, of the ugliness that exists in our world. So it's just about understanding. You're not going to understand it all, but you trust. And I keep getting back to that word all the time. In the end of this year, it's the trust and the willingness to be part of something, because you find people that are bringing you into that club for no real need. You know, there's no one here is, I'm not going to get any commission in Shemayim. No rabbis are going to get a commission in Shemayim or a shortcut in Shemayim. They'll say, Rabbi Tarragon, they're coming to Shemayim. When I come up to Shemayim, I'm not Rabbi Tarragon, I'm Moshe. And the questions Hashem are going to ask me are going to be the same questions you have to face. Did I succeed in Talmud Torah and Yerusha Mayim and Davening and Chesed and Merad Lachavera and Midos? Say, well, you know, I was a little bit lacking in this, but I was a Rebbe. They'll laugh at me. What? I got this guy to be more from. What are you crazy? What does that mean? That doesn't excuse you. You want to do good things. But so I don't have any interest. No one here has any interest in trying to make you more religious because it's going to help us. I'm not going to get a better salary. I'm not going to, you know, win the Rebbe Olympics. I'm not going to win the gold medal. And only because we care. This is our chance to do chesed and to try to bring you closer. So those are the people you have to cling to in life. People that really have no agenda. No one's here for, you know, we could. Last I checked, we have a big yeshiva and the boys are coming. And it's not like I'll be fired if you decide to take it more seriously or less seriously. It's not anything but sincerely devoted to trying to help you grow in avodas Hashem. Those are the people you trust. And okay, now I want to try to personalize it. I want to be like that one, like this one. I have to find my own voice and my own stage and my own pace. But the buy-in that we're talking about, to buy into what's going on in yeshiva and say, these are people I really can trust and I want to listen to their message and try to implement them. That's what makes it such a successful yeshiva, because unfortunately sometimes in high school, the buy-in is harder. The buy-in is harder because there's rules and tests and expelling and detention. And by and large in high schools, you're dealing with larger groups of boys and girls sometimes, so you can't just, you know, assume that the entire student population will respond to the messages with hard work and diligence and focus. So you have to have rules, and the rules make it harder for people to buy in because you feel suppressed by the rules. All of a sudden the rules are pulled back a little bit, so okay, let's just buy in and just try to drink in as much as you can and take it seriously and apply it seriously. You know, for serious boys, that's a real redemptive moment to not be constricted by rules and to feel that it's us versus the authorities, and to break the adversarial ropes of high school. All of a sudden realize it's, you know, we're not here to catch you. Like when a Rebbe comes over to you and says something to you, the last thing on his mind is to make trouble for you. Like it'd be much easier for us to walk into the Beis Medrash, do our thing, punch our ticket, and walk out. So all our energies and as much energy as we try to expend as much as possible simply to create people that are serious about avodas Hashem. Okay, so we'll stop here in a couple extra minutes.